episode 353 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini-episode number 353. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have a very special guest joining us on the program today. I want to thank him and his publisher for forwarding a copy of his most recent book. We will be discussing that today. Our guest today is the founder and chairman of Steiner Sports Marketing and Memorabilia, and he is the author of the book, You Gotta Have Balls, How a Kid from Brooklyn Started from Scratch, Bought Yankee Stadium, and Created a Sports Empire. Our guest on the program today is Brandon Steiner. Brandon, welcome to the program. Sir, how are you today?
Everything's great. Great to be here with you. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Really, I found your book to be very interesting. Appreciate you guys having forwarded that out to us. And in the introduction, being all in, you build to a summary of why you wrote the book, but please summarize or paraphrase for our audience here what your thought process was of putting the book together and why you decided to do it.
Well, first of all, it was my mother's favorite line, "You gotta have balls," was something she commonly would take her elbow, kind of hit me right on the side. And the ribs, and, you know, about being fearless and about not being afraid, and most important, doing things, you know, with a little bit of an edge and a little bit, you know, not only doing things the right way, but doing things in a little bit of a wow kind of way. And that's always how I've kind of conducted Steiner, doing things the right way. Authentic, obviously, is very important, but also the wow factor. We're constantly creating stuff. When you go to steinersports.com, I mean, in a short 25 years, you know, you'll find almost 40,000 SKUs. But as far as the book, I think the book is for basically anybody that is in sales, anybody that's kind of going from good to great. I think you'll relate to the book and relate to the stories. It's really not as much a sports book as you'd think, as it is about really just a good, solid story about how you can, you know, with value proposition and really just productivity, just increasing your productivity, how you can really do a lot more with your life. And I think a lot of the stories you'll read in the book, you'll be able to relate to, even if you're not a sports fan, but if you're somebody in business, that you're really trying to go get more out of what you got, this is a great book to read.
That's a very good point, because it does have an awful lot in it when you go from talking about working at Hard Rock in the early days to work at one of the first big sports bars out there in New York City. There are a lot of things beyond the actual sports world itself for people to digest. But right after the introduction in the book, I want to ask you about this. I want to kind of follow up on a thought process a little bit here, where you were talking about commitment and Michael Jordan's commitment to baseball. And that was a really interesting point, that he didn't have the level of commitment to baseball, obviously, that he did to basketball. But you have to wonder how long the level of commitment would have come from Jerry Reinsdorf after a fairly unsuccessful, at least unspectacular season at Double-A that year. So assuming the White Sox at some point cut ties with him, follow that to its logical extreme here. Do you think he should have bounced around the independent leagues? How far do you think he should have gone in terms of chasing the baseball dream had the White Sox cut ties with him?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for Michael Jordan, but not in this particular case. You know, and I love Michael Jordan for the basketball player that he was and what he brought to the game. But I think, you know, I always say that, you know, commitment leads to passion. Passion does not lead to commitment. A lot of people get excited about a lot of things, but really, in my mind, I like to see people that start off with a commitment that are commitment-oriented, and then that leads them to passion. And I think Michael was very passionate about playing baseball, you know, because I think he had some love for the game. His dad wanted him to play. But when it came down to the commitment and he struggled hitting the curve, I mean, who, after 1 year or a year plus, all of a sudden makes it up to the major leagues? Very few players. And I think it really showed a little bit of the short side there, that if he was that committed about becoming a professional baseball player, I would have liked to think that he would have been a little more committed to doing more than a year plus, you know, in the minor leagues, and then see where it took if he was that committed and he had this true passion and love for the game. And it just showed you, you know, his passion led him to the commitment he made to go to the minor leagues. But I think it starts with a commitment. And the commitment is doing everything and anything you can to make it work and make it happen. And I don't think Michael did that in this particular case. I don't think he did everything that he possibly could for as long as he could. I think he kind of at some point got frustrated, which he's getting some pressure, and I think he shorted it out. Now, if he was down there for 3, 4, 5 years, hey. But, you know, and listen, do I blame him for going back and playing basketball? No. I'm just saying that, I'm just using that as an example, that I think people get confused and they get really passionate about something, and then it doesn't lead them to where they want it to be, and they want to know what happened. What happened was you didn't get to the core of the issue, which was making a commitment and then letting that commitment, no matter what happens, you were not going to get off track. And having that commitment lead you to passion. That, a lot of times, will lead you to the highest level of success, I think.
Well, that's very interesting because, again, he did have unmatched passion for basketball, and story after story has come out about how that was necessary for him, how he would use slights, imagined or real, to kind of propel himself. And anybody that remembers his Hall of Fame speech where he was, frankly, kind of a jerk to a few people, that kind of seeped out. You could see the competitiveness.
Yeah.
You could see the passion that he had. But I'm wondering at all what you're saying about his baseball career. Does that possibly inform the prism through which we look at his ownership of the Charlotte franchise down there? There's been some questions from time to time about his level of commitment, occasionally been kind of an absentee owner of the team. At a bare minimum, that team has lost a lot more as an owner than he would have ever tolerated as a player. So do you see a little bit of a strand kind of in the same thing here with his ownership of that singular passion that he had for playing the game of basketball, maybe not carrying over to everything?
I think it's complicated. You know, running and owning an NBA team these days, I wouldn't want to be one. I wouldn't want to be an owner. It's so hard. I mean, you look around the NBA and players can potentially move around and trying to figure out who's got the long-term talent and who doesn't. You know, Kobe was a late draft pick, picked him out of high school. And who knows who these kids are and what they're going to turn out to be. It's just such a crapshoot. But listen, my big question to Michael is, like, who's giving him the training and who's mentoring him to be a business person on that level, in that capacity? Why do you think that you can be, just because you're such a great basketball player, and you've been a good entrepreneur. I mean, he's done well with Air Jordan. He's done very well with some partnerships, but that doesn't mean that you automatically could own a team and understand how to run a team. And I think that my big question to him would be is, you haven't been doing all that well. Who's mentoring you? Who's teaching you? And who's showing you the ropes? I'd like to think he's got some people in his camp, you know, guiding him and mentoring him. And I wouldn't judge the success of an NBA team and put it all on him, because there's a lot of failed franchises out there when you think about it. I mean, some teams that have not really won at all, won in a long time. He's not alone. You know, we can go over to Sacramento and look at the 76ers, and you know, we could slide over to a whole bunch of teams that really have struggled over the last 10 years. But at some point, he's going to have to get that team somewhat in order. And I do think that committed management always figures out a way. Show me a good team and I'll show you good management. Show me a lousy team and I'll show you probably a good chance, not so good management. I think that's pretty fair judgment to say that, you know, good companies are run by good people, and usually if there's a bad company, there's a good chance it's run by bad people.
Sure, that's a very logical progression there. And again, as far as the concept of mentoring and teaching and learning from people, you kind of anticipated where I wanted to go next with this from your book. And that would be in terms of some of the celebrities that are in your book that you mentioned that you've had dealings with over the years, whether it be a Derek Jeter, whether it be a Lou Holtz, a really kind of a spectrum of people, some younger than you, some older than you. Where would you say the examples are of the ones who have really meant the most in terms of life lessons that you've picked up from them?
So many. I mean, you know, one of the things I like to say that I've been smart enough to realize is that, you know, I don't throw a ball really particularly fast and don't jump that high. And I realize that the talent is the talent. I'm just a business guy. But I think when, you know, with somebody who's really, really good at what they do, or certainly one of the best at what they do in any category, whether it be the guy, the sanitation guy, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a ball player or a coach, you got to take out a piece of paper and take notes. I think, you know, the world is your classroom. You can learn something from everyone. And I've been, you know, when I'm with a lot of these players, a lot of times you get a little bit confused, you know, a little delusional, because she gets so caught up in the celebrity hype. And what I've been able to do is realize, hey, this guy is a perennial all-star, won some World Series or won some Super Bowls. I can learn something. If somebody's been really, really dominant or great at what they're doing, regardless, you can learn from them. And I think Mark Messier is probably one of the guys I've learned the most from, you know, about teamwork and about leadership and about family and about how you treat your teammates and respecting the game, respecting the industry you're in. He's one of my favorites. I've learned a tremendous amount from Mariano Rivera. Learned a lot of business from Roger Staubach. He was a very smart businessman, extremely authentic, committed, you know, obviously to his country, to business, to his family. I had a nice little run with him. Same thing with Yogi Berra. Had some great experiences and learning lessons with Yogi. Also very similar, his respect and authentication to the game that he played, but yet, you know, keeping it real. And I think the best guys are the guys that are able to keep it separate, keep their feet on the ground, and stay humble. When they get to the top of the hill, you know, they may look down, but they don't look down on people. You know, they keep their head straight, and they've got some sense of normal, even though the celebrity stuff is driving them, you know, to be a little crazy.
Absolutely.
There's so many. I mean, we could spend an hour talking about the lessons learned. It's a great question, because I know I talk a lot about it in the book, but there is so many lessons you can learn. Because I do think celebrity and fame and fortune do give you the blueprint of who you really are. It just shows who you really are. Like, you see these guys that make all this money, and then, you know, they're getting in jail for drugs, or they get in jail because they beat up their wife, whatever. This is who these guys were before, you know, they became rich and famous. I mean, this is what they are. They, you know, just because you become rich and famous doesn't change the person who you really are. Matter of fact, it magnifies it.
Absolutely. And there's a great saying from the great pro wrestler Arn Anderson back in the day about adversity introduces a man to himself. So that's kind of along the lines of what you're talking about here, that we are who we are, and then the circumstances just kind of reveal that, don't they?
Yes, 100%. I agree with that.
Absolutely. And in the course of this book, intertwined, of course, with the life story that you're telling, there's an awful lot in there about the evolution of the sports marketing industry memorabilia over the last three decades or so, and everything that you've done with Steiner Sports Marketing. I'm curious, just because I had a question put to me fairly recently from a friend of mine, one of our contributors to the show, actually, who was trying to unload some of his cards from back in the day, and was kind of surprised at the softness of the market. And that's the kind of thing that I've heard about in recent years. What would you say accounts for that as far as trading cards go versus the explosion in worth that there has been for certain dedicated items out there, such as a lot of the things that you talk about in the book from Yankee Stadium and the like? It seems like if it's a fairly unique item, and maybe I'm answering my own question here, but those things, there never seems to be an end to the demand for, and yet for trading cards, it seems to have been a lot more finite in recent years.
Well, the trading card business, I always looked at it as very critical. I think it's in critical condition right now because, you know, kids are just not buying trading cards like they used to, and it just has a different feel. And maybe the league screwed it up because they just printed too many cards, and they lost kind of that little bit of a special feel to them. And also the cards got very expensive. But I think, you know, trading cards are in critical condition. They do need to get revived because that's the way we learned about the sport. We learn about the player. We learn about the stats. And baseball cards are extremely relevant as far as why we, you know, consider triple crown players and 500 home run hitters and 3,000. These are all the things that enable us to what makes baseball such a special sport. So I'm nervous about the trading card business, but I'm hoping it can be revived. But then the PlayStation stuff has kind of subsidized that. It's gotten the younger kids knowledgeable about all the players and who they are and everything in a different kind of way. So that's where the leveling out has been, and that's probably the trade-off. I think it's, you know, it's a big part of collecting. I still collect trading cards, I'll admit it, although I do collect a lot of things. But, I wished I had a solution for the trading card companies, although the game use component, we were able to buy these trading cards with game use products in them, has certainly been a small solution, at least in the recent years, where it's definitely given the industry a little bit of a pop, and it's made the trading card industry a lot more exciting.
Absolutely, and what you mentioned about games as well, it is pretty cool in a video game, say, for example, to be able to pull up Jimmy Fox in a home run hitting contest. And maybe that's a little bit of a portal for younger generations to learn the history a little bit more and really kind of brush up on these guys. So, yeah, maybe there are different delivery systems out there as far as impressing upon folks the history of it. But there's another thing in there that I really kind of picked up on later in the book when you were talking about the new Yankee Stadium, and it seemed to kind of click in my head with something that I have heard with a sister entity of ours, FantasyDraftHelp.com, and the criticism that sometimes I hear along the lines of people saying, oh, I miss when it was just a game, and before you fantasy people were commodifying everything. And the word commodifying kind of came to mind as you were describing about when you look around Yankee Stadium and what might this be worth at this place, what might that be worth. I'm sure there's a decent amount of criticism that comes your way from people who yearn for this purer yesterday when we weren't having conversations like this. So what are your thoughts when you hear such criticisms? Do you kind of brush it off, or do you think about it a little bit?
Well, I think about it all because I think the quantity and you know, it's certainly the, you know, there's this economics of, you know, having too much or not enough and what is the demand. I certainly don't think that the actual demand of authentic, cool collectibles, whether it be signatures and a lot of the stuff that we create here, will ever meet up to the demand. I mean, if you took a poll of all the people in the United States and asked them, you know, who would want a Derek Jeter signed ball just to have in their office, you know, Derek would have to sign a ball for the rest of his life to meet up to the people that wanted one. Now, whether they can afford one or not is another story, and that's how you're trying to figure out what the actual, you know, equation is here. But the demand is there if the price was right. And that's what I'm constantly trying to figure out, is like how many people would really love to have a pair of Mickey Mantle game-used cleats from the year of his Triple Crown. And then you start thinking about these things, and, you know, there's a good amount of people out there who would like them. The question is, how much would they pay to have and be able to put that in your living room or in your man cave? But, you know, I don't worry about those people that say that, you know, part of what they're saying is probably true. You know, there is a little bit of a commodity-like feel to some of the collectibles that are being put out there. The word collectible has certainly been an overused and abused term, which bothers me and concerns me, because there's a lot of things that just ain't a collectible. I mean, there's just some things that are being put out there that they say is a collectible and just isn't. And I think the definition of a collectible is certainly something that is a product or is an item that is, it can be produced, or it's something that is, you know, worn, or something that is gotten, but definitely has a limited amount and a beginning and an end. And any time you have something where there's unlimited quantities to be made, you'd have to really question the usage of the word collectible. So my biggest challenge is, how do I make not enough? How do I actually figure out how many people want an item that I'm about to make or create or do or find, and make sure that there's not enough so that it becomes a true collectible?
That's a very good point. I mean, there's no equivalent of the FDA out there regulating what is and is not a collectible. So it is kind of the Wild West as far as representations that some folks, especially if they're a little bit unscrupulous, are able to make. So that has to be a headache for you in terms of dealing with that. Now, consciously or otherwise, not long after that part of the book there, and like I said, the thought in some people's head about these type matters is nothing sacred. You actually get into a matter about something sacred, about the Wailing Wall over in Jerusalem and plans for potentially raising money around that. And again, steering, so we should say, back into repairs and being able to share the experience with most people who are not able to make it over there. But I found that to be very interesting. So I kind of went back and forth in my head. I personally, I'm not Jewish. I am Roman Catholic, so I'm looking at it through the prism of the Vatican. And I'm thinking, well, okay, you know, even the Vatican probably has gift shops there. So on that one, and you indicated this is a project you're presently pursuing, are you getting any kind of static about that when you're dealing with something as sensitive to so many people?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing up that subject. A lot of people don't get, you know, a lot of people that interview me don't get that far in the book, because that's towards the end. And it's a little bit of a delusional level of my thinking sometimes, to be honest with you, for the listeners out there, because, you know, I have a lot of, you know, quadruple ADD going on. So when I go on these vacations, sometimes I have a hard time, you know, with the sightseeing, and then I start daydreaming. And this was a trip to Israel where I started thinking about selling souvenirs and collectibles from the Holy Wall. And I did pursue it, and I did get a contract from the City of David, from the people. There's a fundraising group and a charity group out there that works with creating products. And you know something? I walked from it. I had a deal, and they come here to visit and see our operation. You know, we have a 60,000 square foot operation here in New York City, and they, you know, saw the different thousands of products I've done with game used dirt and rubble and rocks and bricks, and they were all set. You know, we had a contract that was ready to go to create these holy wall products, and you know, I just didn't feel right. And when I went to them and I said I'm going to pass on this deal, and I'd spoke with a few rabbis, I just thought spiritually, you know, I was crossing over the line. It just didn't feel good to me, you know. And what I did say to them is, I said, listen, I'd like you to take all these ideas, and maybe if you have some internal ways to work this so that it can raise money and help people authentically, 100%, please steal every one of my ideas and please use these ideas. And if I can guide you and consult with you to help you, I'd be more than glad to do so. But it wasn't a project that I decided Steiner Sports was going to pull the trigger on. I just didn't feel right about it. You know, listen, when you get into the religious stuff, it's not, I'm not an expert on this stuff, nor I don't know if anybody is, but, you know, I have to go with my gut. When you get into the sports stuff, you know, have I crossed over the line a little bit? Maybe a little, but, you know, never getting in the way of the game. I mean, we've had some arguments with a few players about, you know, certain things that the teams have given us that they weren't happy about. But generally speaking, I never get in the way of the game getting played the way it needs to get played.
Well, I think that's an appropriate decision, especially the way that you described it there and what the thought process was. That in the end, I can understand that not feeling right as far as going ahead with it. You had emphasized in the book, that as of when it went to press anyways, that that was something that was still going to be pending. So this is a little bit of an exclusive update, I guess, for our audience here as far as the status of that project. But
it's the first time I've talked about it, actually. It's the first time I've talked about it. I haven't brought it up because it was something that was lingering on for a few months. I feel very confident about, you know, walking from that project. My wife was, like, down on me right from the beginning. She's like, you're not doing that. Don't do that. And so I have voted once in a while. But, you know, as we all know, if you want to have a happy life, you want to have a happy wife. And, I usually don't outvote my wife on certain decisions. But in this particular one, I went and got some outside counseling. And I really went to three rabbis and a couple of religious friends just to ask them what their thoughts were. And believe it or not, on this particular thing, they none of them said, Brandon, don't do this. They all said you should go with your gut and go with what you think is right. A couple of them actually said, you know, it seems like you're going to be doing some good. You're going to be raising some money. Steiner Sports is really going to be making very little money on this, if any, and you're raising most of the money for them. And I just said, you know, my gut says no.
Well, you know, and this is kind of a sensitive a follow-up question, I understand, but it's something that just kind of comes to mind anyways. And when you're looking at Israel and the Middle East and some of the ugliness that goes on in that part of the world, was there any kind of sense at any point, I'm guessing that none of the rabbis had raised it with you, any kind of fear at all raised by anybody of potentially stirring up, however inadvertently, some anti-Semitism in terms of perceived commodification of the wall, or did that not really arise in anybody's mind?
Nah, it didn't come up. It didn't go that far enough for that to happen, but, you know, I always hear weird things. You know, we've sold over $40 million of game-used dirt and bricks and grass, and you know, we sell a lot of unusual commodities, and those are somewhat commodities, but they're feel-good commodities, and they're
yes.
products that people enjoy, and I always take a lot of heat on those, and I expect that comes with the territory.
Well, that's very interesting to hear how that played out and what your thought process was. And as I say, I agree with the conclusion that you came to, especially after hearing you kind of run through that. And it's very interesting to get into that with you because we do enjoy talking about as many different topics as possible on this show. So it's very interesting to be able to scratch the surface on that with you. But you'd alluded to that as a project that was in the hopper, something that you might have coming next. And obviously, again, you're in the process of getting the word out there about this book. You got to have balls, how a kid from Brooklyn started from scratch, bought Yankee Stadium, and created a sports empire. But beyond that, Brandon, what are some of the next things that you're looking at as you continue to develop Steiner Sports Marketing and your other projects?
Well, you know, lately I've been on more of a kick about not inventing things, but really improving them. I've been on more of an improving mode and really trying to tighten up some of the products we've done and making them a little better, making them more cost sensitive for our customers, because, you know, money's a little tight these days. The economy's still in some respects a little wobbly. So I've really been honing in on trying to deliver more value and really taking what I think is an exceptional product line, frankly, that we've created here, and figuring out ways to, you know, get people closer to it, closer to the game, so making it more affordable and giving people a chance to meet a lot more of these players and figure out ways to do that. I really feel like this is probably the best run we've ever had at Steiner Sports. So, you know, what's next is I'm hoping a little more rock and roll. I'd like to do a little more rock and roll memorabilia. What's next is probably doing some unusual sports. You know, looking at things like the Preakness or Breeders' Cup, you know, some horse racing and taking those horseshoes right off the horse, right on the winner's circle, and selling those, you know, things like that. I'm very serious about soccer in 2014. I would say that's my number one initiative of something we haven't done here at Steiner that we're going about to do internationally and here in the States with MLS. And then I may even do a little cricket. You know, I'm just hiring somebody that's going to go out to Europe and really kind of go get a sense for Man U and Chelsea and really see what's going on with cricket in India and around the world, and really just try to get kind of in that world. I feel like the American team sports, well, I mean, listen, I love American team sports. I don't want to bite the hand that's feeding me, but you know, it's definitely a little bit, in a lot of respects, I just feel it's a little bit overplayed. It's a little bit too much. I turn on a TV, there's just too many games on, and I think in Europe, I think things are still fresh, you know, with soccer and cricket and maybe even a little basketball there.
Absolutely. On a global scale, there are many markets that are fairly undeveloped yet, so it's very wise to be looking in that direction. It's one of the few in this country that really still seems to be on the upward curve, largely because it's so young in terms of how long it's been around, is MMA. Have there been any thoughts in terms of expanding with MMA merchandise?
Not really, no.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Just curious.
I've been staying away from the NASCAR and the car racing because I'm not feeling that, although a lot of people have pushed me that way. But so, you know, I'm all open ears. I get a call a day on somebody with an absurd idea, but every now and then they're pretty good.
Well, I'm sure it's going to be fascinating to continue sifting through these ideas and developing them, and it's been very interesting talking with you today, Brandon. Again, the title
yes.
of the book, You Gotta Have Balls, How a Kid from Brooklyn Started from Scratch, Bought Yankee Stadium, and Created a Sports Empire. We appreciate having you on the program, Brandon. We'd be interested in keeping up with you as time goes along. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
It's been fun. Keep in touch, and happy holidays.
Thank you very much. Happy holidays to you too, Brandon. And thank you all for tuning in, everybody. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 353.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.